For the senior officers of the Wehrmacht and important members of the staff, he made a brand stamped SRK. Sonderfertigung Reichskanzlei. Special product for the Reich Chancellery, wrapped not in gold but in silver. Soon the senior officers were fighting over the moderately tasty sweets, which were ostentatiously consumed at military briefings. Morell wrote contentedly from the Führer's headquarters to his wife, "Walter Malton is proving a great success here. All the gentlemen are very appreciative of it and recommend it to their families at home." This success laid the foundation for large-scale deals with the mass organizations of the Third Reich. Shamelessly exploiting his influence as Hitler's personal physician, Morell won over the German Labor Front, DAF, for several Walter Malton operations. Huge quantities were ordered, sometimes 260 million, then even 390 million. Overall, the DAF took almost a billion tablets. The goal was to heighten the performance of munitions workers and increase their resistance to infectious diseases. The doctor also approached the SS, who received 100,000 free Walter Malton biscuits as an affectionate gift. These were supposed to get the Mountain Corps in Norway hooked. At a special discussion with Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, Morell touted the usefulness of Walter Malton in Scandinavia. It was demonstrably clear that an increased intake of vitamin C improved night vision, and up there it was often dark. The SS seemed pleased with the result and ordered more, hundreds of millions in all. The product even received a special edition branding of its own and bore the label SS Walter Malton. The commercially focused doctor also fixed his sights on the ground troops. "Mustn't we offer Walter Malton to the army again?" he wrote in a letter. But when he approached Ranke, the dealer for the Wehrmacht, Morell found he was banging his head against a brick wall. The advisory defense physiologist, used to stronger stuff, wasn't impressed by a mere vitamin preparation and refused to pack the bars in the troops' equipment. But the Walter Malton business worked without the army. Morell could even cope with a rejection by the Luftwaffe, although he did take it personally and plotted against Dr. Erich Hipke, leader of the Luftwaffe medical service. On the basis of false data, the Generalstabsarzt, senior staff surgeon general, is trying to disavow a valuable preparation and circulating a letter seeking to defame me, Morell wrote to Hipke's superior, the Reich Aviation Minister Göring. "I can't calmly accept such a mode of behavior, which has happened on duty. If it had happened in private life, I would go to court. So I ask you, my dear Reich Marshal, to be so kind as to make a just judgment. In deepest respect for you, Herr Reich Marshal, I remain yours, Heil Hitler." Göring reacted, and Hipke had to go. This was a triumph for the physician. His own rise to becoming a pan-European pharmaceutical entrepreneur was off to a good start. Flying High, the Battle of Britain. After the fiasco of Dunkirk, for which the blame was laid at his door, Göring, the fat man, tried desperately to appear as the radiant lordly figure he imagined himself to be when under the effects of morphine. Operation Sea Lion was planned, the invasion of Great Britain with ground units. For the precarious sea journey of thousands of German soldiers across the English Channel, air supremacy also had to be achieved so as not to risk the troops. This was Göring's job, as well as his great opportunity to impress Hitler and justify his great power, as well as the extravagant lifestyle that went with it. The Battle of Britain was beginning. To force Britain to its knees from the air, Göring first bombed logistical air force targets, aerodromes, hangars, landing strips, planes. This successful strategy was changed, however, after the British bombed the Berlin districts of Kreuzberg and Wedding in a night raid on August 25, 1940. Hitler ordered an attack on London for September 4th to demoralize its population, a severe tactical error, because it meant that enemy airfields were no longer the prime target. Consequently, the British were able to strengthen their defenses. Bombs fell on the British capital and other towns. Over 40,000 civilians had lost their lives by the end of the campaign. These were the first systematic terror attacks of the war. On the island there was a grim comment, "London can take it." The Royal Air Force, RAF, struck resolutely back. Countless German planes were shot down over England, and the British flew retaliatory attacks against German cities. The clash escalated. Soon it became too dangerous for the Luftwaffe to operate by day. One bomber pilot describes the situation. The launch was often very late, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and then you were over London or some other English city at about 1 or 2 in the morning. And of course then you were tired. So you took 1 or 2 Pervitin tablets, and then you were all right again. I had a lot of night operations, you know. And of course the commander always has to have his wits about him. So I took Pervitin as a precautionary measure. Imagine the commander being tired in battle. Yes, please, that's not going to work. One wouldn't abstain from Pervitin because of a little health scare. Who cares when you're doomed to come down at any moment anyway? This certainly wasn't a one-off remark. There are no statistical studies of Pervitin among the Luftwaffe, and by historiographical standards there is little supporting evidence of the comprehensive use of the Speedamin among pilots, apart from Ranke's original order of 35 million doses for the Army and the Luftwaffe together. Control of the skies was essential to win the war, and to do that you needed the right materials, steel and manpower. Both had to function perfectly and keep going longer than the enemy could. While Messerschmitts were technically inferior to Spitfires, the Luftwaffe's use of drugs was far ahead of that in the RAF. Pervitin had several nicknames that indicated its use. Pilot salt, Stuka pills, Goering pills. One commodore reported from the Mediterranean, "In my knee pocket there is a hand-length strip of linen covered with cellophane, with 5 or 6 milk-white tablets stuck to it, the size of a chocolate bar. The label reads, Pervitin, tablets against fatigue. I open the bag and tear first 2, then 3 of these tablets from the pad, take the breathing mask off my face for a moment, and start chewing the tablets. They taste repellently bitter and flowery, and I've got nothing to wash them down with." After a while, the effect kicked in. "The engine is running cleanly and calmly. I'm wide awake. My heartbeat thunders in my ears. Why is the sky suddenly so bright? My eyes hurt in the harsh light. I can hardly bear the brilliance. If I shield my eyes with my free hand, it's better. Now the engine is humming evenly and without vibration. Far away, very far away. It's almost like silence up here. Everything becomes immaterial and abstract, remote, as if I were flying above my plane." After landing, reality was a strange world for the Zonked pilot. "I kept my course precisely, in spite of my euphoric indifference and my seemingly weightless state. Upon landing, I find the place in a state of complete stasis. Nothing moves. There's no one to be seen. Rubble of the hangars forlornly looms between the bomb craters. As I roll on to the squadron's stand, my right tire bursts. I've probably driven over a bomb splinter. Later I meet Dr. Sperling and ask him in passing what kind of crap this Pervitin really is and whether it mightn't be better to warn pilots in advance. When he learns that I've taken 3 tablets, he nearly faints and forbids me to touch a plane, even from outside, for the rest of the day." As hopped up as the Germans might have been, this couldn't give them the advantage over the Royal Air Force, which was plainly better run. The Battle of Britain was lost by the Reich, Germany's first defeat in this war. Hitler had to call off Operation Sea Lion, and thus an invasion of Britain, and looked for a new theater for his war. Consequences weren't drawn from this new failure on Goering's part. He still held court in the huge building of the Reich Aviation Ministry, built of pale stone blocks on Wilhelmstrasse. Red Reich war flags, emblazoned with a swastika, fluttered confidently above, as if to point out unequivocally that even the winds were subject to the power of this government, and particularly to that of the Reich Marshal. But anyone who passed through the big cast-iron gate and crossed the broad forecourt stepped into a realm of chaos, of unbridled alcohol and drug abuse, of intrigues and of general mismanagement. The conditions in Goering's 3,000-room fortress, which today houses the Federal Ministry of Finance, were symptomatic of the regime's loss of political reality and the wrong track that Germany had set off on. An officer described the Reich Marshal's appearance. We struggled to keep a straight face. He dons a white silk blouse-like shirt with flowing sleeves, and over it a yellow sleeveless, fur-lined suede jacket. With this he sports long medieval-looking bloomers, and around his waist a broad gold-studded leather belt with a short Celtic sword jangling from it. Long silk stockings and golden-yellow Saffiano leather sandals complete the picture. The face of the powerful minister was covered in makeup, and his fingernails were painted red. Often during discussions, Goering, once the opium content of his blood had dropped, felt so deranged that he would leave the room abruptly without a word of explanation and not come back until a few minutes later, plainly much refreshed. A general described one such surprising transformation. Goering had the air of being newborn. He looked magnificent and fixed his sparkling blue eyes on us. The difference in his whole appearance between the first and second parts of our conference was notable. For me, it was clear that he had been taking some form of stimulant. These frequent escapes from reality didn't help Goering's official duties. Soon, the precondition for holding a senior post in his office was not so much one's qualifications as one's entertainment value. He swept aside criticisms of one of his closest colleagues, Bruno Lurzer, whom Goering himself described as his laziest general, with the remark, "I need someone I can drink a bottle of red wine with in the evening." Similar considerations may also have played a part in the appointment of Ernst Udet as Generalluftzeugmeister, or General Master of Aircraft, one of the most influential positions in the Third Reich. Admittedly, after the Frenchman René Fonck, Udet was very popular as the most successful surviving fighter pilot of any nation in the First World War. But this exceptionally gifted flyer and bon viveur, who enjoyed his cameo appearances in Leni Riefenstahl films, struggled with his desk job at the top level of the leadership. Goering couldn't care less, however, and his treatment of Udet was a particularly impressive example of how capriciously he ran his ministry, where the concept of administrative supervision was unheard of. When the Reich Aviation Minister and his Generalluftzeugmeister talked together, they liked to reminisce about the good old days, when they had fought aerial battles together in the First World War, high on cocaine. On the other hand, they were less keen on talking about current armament problems, the complex process of developing new types of aircraft, and other similarly intricate matters. At his opening speech at the ministry, Udet admitted, his face cloudy and terribly hungover, that it would be unwise to expect him to perform many administrative duties. The only problem was that he was now in charge of up to 24 different offices, which were soon in a state of indescribable chaos. Udet, who was known to serve cognac at meetings throughout the day and to take methamphetamine in enormous quantities to balance out the effects of the alcohol, was notorious for extraordinary mismanagement even within the inefficient Reich Aviation Ministry. It's possible that Goering was referring to Udet when he observed, "There are departments you have no idea about, but all at once they appear, and promptly some mess happens, and swiftly you discover there's been a department there for years and no one knows anything about it. In all seriousness, it's happened a few times. There are people who have been thrown out three times, and then they reappear in a different department and become bigger and bigger." Udet particularly liked to spend his days drawing caricatures, often enough of himself. Whenever possible, he crept off home, where he ran a small private bar decorated with trophies from his world travels, and always surrounded himself with friends because he couldn't bear to be alone. Although he just wanted to be sitting in a plane stunt-flying, there was no time for that now, Udet was imploding under the burden of his constantly increasing responsibilities. In the course of 1941, he shoveled Pervitin into his mouth in dangerous quantities to keep himself capable of functioning. In that way, he personified the hubris of German warfare, which had overstretched itself and lost contact with reality long ago. "Our defeat was caused by Udet," Hitler, of all people, would later claim. "That man concocted the most nonsensical state of affairs ever seen in the history of the Luftwaffe." And that was saying something. In the German theater play most often performed after the war, The Devil's General, the dramatist Karl Zuckmayer gave his friend Udet far too flattering a monument in the figure of the honorably tragic, nonchalant swashbuckler, Air Force General Harris. Udet was not worthy of such a heroic status. At best, one might say in his favor that he unwittingly might have done great damage to the system through his incompetence and drug addiction. So he is no more and no less than a buffoon, a historical curiosity, and he embodies those deviant qualities that historians usually ignore. On November 17, 1941, a report from the German news service came over the ticker. General Luftzeugmeister, Air Chief Marshal Udet, while testing a new weapon, suffered such a severe accident that he died of his injuries on the way to the hospital. The Führer has ordered a state funeral for an officer who was lost so tragically while carrying out his duty. In fact, Udet had fired a bullet into his head at his grand villa on Stallupener Allee in Westend, Berlin's most exclusive residential area, and at a stroke delegated all the 1,000 technical and organizational problems of the Luftwaffe back to his old fellow soldier from the First World War, Göring. Just before he brought his intoxicated life to an end with a bang, Udet had scribbled one last message beside his deathbed. "Iron Man, you have deserted me." The suicide of the self-aggrandizing Udet anticipated the downfall of the Third Reich. As Göring walked behind the coffin at the state funeral, with a metallic morphine-doped expression, and muttered something about one of the greatest heroes in German history, the Wehrmacht was getting stuck in Russia. Just behind the military medical academy, in the Invalidenfriedhof, only a few steps from the place where Otto Ranke had tested Pervitin for the Wehrmacht, Udet's grave can still be seen today. Just what the world was waiting for. On September 13, 1940, the Milan daily Corriere della Sera reported on a courage pill used by the Germans, which had gone from medicine to secret weapon. The military effectiveness of this pillola di coraggio, the article said, wasn't a match for a Stuka bomb, but it did guarantee the German general staff the uninterrupted operational capability of its soldiers. Britain went on to study and eventually use benzedrine, which has fewer side effects than Pervitin, as a result of the Milan Peace. The article provided the reassuring explanation that the Germans' relentless fighting power could be explained chemically rather than ideologically. The British Broadcasting Company immediately produced a feature on the provision of Pervitin to German pilots. As a result, a controversy at the highest level of the civil service broke out in Berlin. Leo Conti, the Reich Health Führer, who was critical of Pervitin, wrote to the Army medical inspector, "I would be grateful if you could tell me in what quantities and with what degree of success Pervitin is actually being administered to members of the Luftwaffe. I would also like to know your attitude towards this issue. I cannot approve the prescription of Pervitin. After repeated declarations of the harmfulness of this substance, I have wondered whether stricter regulations should be introduced concerning the prescription of Pervitin, perhaps identifying it as an intoxicating drug." Heil Hitler. This letter made little impression on the army. It was not until a month later that their new army medical inspector, Professor Siegfried Handloser, wrote, "British propaganda has claimed several times that the German Wehrmacht is only capable of its achievements thanks to drugs. The fallacy of these reports by London radio is apparent from the fact that they also have German panzer divisions in France marching on drugs. The fact is that Pervitin was only used at that time by individuals and in vanishingly small quantities." A clear lie, because Handloser must have been aware of both the 35 million tablets ordered for the Western campaign and Ranke's report from France. Conti wouldn't leave the matter alone. Stubbornly, he fought for his ideological ideas of a poison-free Aryan nation. At the same time, he misjudged the realities of the geopolitical competition of the Second World War and its crying need for doping. In an act of desperation, he engaged a scientist friend to write under the headline "The Pervitin Problem," the first major critical piece on the favorite drug of the Germans, regarding the dangers of the stimulant and its violently addictive properties. In typical Nazi terminology, he called for Pervitin to be eradicated wherever we find it, and stressed that anyone who was addicted to it was degenerate. In fact, the article touched a nerve in scientific circles, and cases of Pervitin dependency were now discussed more and more frequently, whether it was doctors who consumed several doses a day, or medical students who took a similar number of tablets and were then unable to sleep for nights, scratching their skin bloody looking for imaginary vermin. In Germany, the use of the substance now ran to over 1 million doses per month. In February 1941, Conti again delivered a warning, this time in an internal memo to the party. "I am following up with mounting concern the terrible abuse being practiced in the widest circles of the population. This is an immediate danger to the health and future of our people." At last, the Reich Health Führer acted, or at least attempted to, and on June 12, 1941, made Pervitin subject to the Reich Opium Law. By doing so, he officially declared the people's drug to be an intoxicant. This act, however, did not lead to a restriction in its use. In fact, it meant only a formal victory for Conti and his ideologically motivated officials. The Reich Health Führer, once one of the most powerful men in the National Socialist state, waged a lonely battle and went on to lose more and more influence. The population was less concerned with Conti's campaign against drugs than it was with the mounting strains of the war, which were easier to endure with the help of the chemical stimulant, even if that meant becoming dependent on it. The Germans barely took any notice of the rigorous prohibition, let alone observed it. Civilian use even increased by over 1.5 million units a year. In this way, the drug revealed the internal contradictions of the National Socialist state and played a part in the process of its gradual self-dissolution. It wasn't long before a total of over 100 million doses had reached German stomachs and bloodstreams. Where use by the military was concerned, the date chosen for the ban on Pervitin was more than risky, because Germany was due to attack the Soviet Union 10 days later, and the soldiers had developed a high tolerance by now. The Wehrmacht High Command, along with the Reich Ministry for Arms and Ammunition, endorsed by Goering, had even classified Pervitin as decisive for the outcome of the war. There was no trace of restriction. Drug use wasn't the only thing about to explode in the summer of 1941. 3. High Hitler, Patient A and His Personal Physician, 1941 to 1944. The doctor's task in peace and war, if it is done correctly, is always one of leadership in the truest sense of the word. The relationship of trust between doctor and patient must be made in such a way that the doctor always and at all times has the feeling of standing over the patient. Being a doctor means being the stronger of two. From the text of a speech by Theodor Morell. The sometimes rather obscure guild of Hitler researchers is united by a desire finally to decipher the enigma of the dictator, probably the worst criminal and psychopath of all time. It looks like there is little progress. The public events have been grasped by biographers for decades. A wide range of literature of all kinds is fully available. Even though more has been written and is still being written about this person than about anyone else in the world, even though the psychopathography of Adolf Hitler is a psychiatric subject in its own right, which deals exclusively with notional psychological diseases of the man from Braunau, no one seems to have come to grips with the mystery. The dubious mythology burns on. Could it be that in the literature on Hitler there is a blind spot? However diverse the research might have become. I am intervening here in a sort of trial based on circumstantial evidence over which scholars have been arguing for years, and which has also led to massive scandals and famous forgeries, such as the so-called Hitler Diaries published in Stern magazine a few decades ago. We should always remain suspicious of some sources. I cannot present a definite solution to the enigma, but will offer a particular reading of the issues involved. Anyone who wishes to approach Hitler should take a detour via Morell, the fat doctor in the light brown gabardine coat. It was, after all, in the autumn of 1941, the point where the dip in Hitler's performance became obvious, and where all the books on him reveal a vacuum because they can't adequately explain that dip, that Morel ceases to be the curious, marginal figure of most historical accounts. In Joachim C. Fest's 900-page biography, Hitler, the physician is mentioned only 7 times, the first instance no earlier than on page 535. The author's accurate description of Hitler's narcotic trance remains unexplained, and when Fest speaks of him becoming fatally drug-dependent, the extent and symptoms of that addiction are not touched upon. Fest claimed that nothing new about Hitler could possibly come out after the publication of his own work in 1973, because it had been proven that we can expect no further material which could even begin to modify the picture of the era and its protagonists. This has now been proven premature. Even if history is attempting to shift the focus away from details about Hitler's life to historical processes that influenced his rise and made him what he was, beside those quite reasonable endeavors, there remains a vacuum that needs to be filled. It isn't enough to speak blandly about Dr. Morel's colorful pills. And when the British historian Ian Kershaw, himself an author of a famous Hitler biography, maintains that the increased number of pills and injections provided every day by Dr. Morel, 90 varieties in all during the war and 28 different pills each day, could not prevent Hitler's physical deterioration, he possibly confuses cause and effect. For the German historian Dr. Heinrich Eberle, matters are less ambiguous. He comes to the conclusion that the head of the German state was not at all addicted to drugs, and Morel had acted entirely responsibly. However, the doctor himself seems to contradict this statement. In his notes, he records a conversation with his patient in the following terms: "I always had to carry out short treatments with high doses, and had to go to the boundaries of the permissible, even though many colleagues might have condemned me for it, but I did and can bear the responsibility, because if treatment had been suspended at the present time, Germany would have been brought to its knees." So, what did Hitler really take, and what is its significance? Can historical events and developments be linked to pharmacological preparations? For years, Morel painstakingly recorded the medications he used to keep his patient constantly on the go. Meticulous records were required in case anything happened to Hitler, in which case Morel would have had to hand over his detailed reports to the Gestapo. This gave rise to an immense bundle of papers, unique in medical history and overflowing with details. Anyone with the desire to decipher the collection has to visit several sites to put together the various fragments of the doctor's estate. A chunk is in the Federal Archive in Koblenz, another part in the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich, and a third, significant portion in Washington, D.C. On-site visit, National Archives, Washington, D.C. Reminiscent of an ancient temple, the monumental archive building stands on Pennsylvania Avenue in the innermost administrative district of the victorious power of the Second World War. The White House on the same street is just a stone's throw away. Words are chiseled into pale stone beside the entrance: "What is past is prologue." Inside, there is an overwhelming sense of confusion. Finding documents isn't easy. There are simply too many of them. Like an enormous vacuum cleaner, the armed forces and intelligence services of the United States sucked up mountains of files from the German Reich and deposited them in Washington and College Park in Maryland, the biggest archive building in the world. To help you find your way through the holdings, there are catalogs, computer hubs, and most importantly, the personal help of archivists who effortlessly managed to cope with such complicated German specialist terms as Reichssicherheitshauptamt. From the very outset, Paul Brown, who helps me with my Morel research, dampens my hope of finding everything about Hitler's personal physician here. He compares my investigations at the archive with skipping flat pebbles over the water. Total access, complete immersion, doesn't exist, he reckons. You simply cannot exhaust the whole of the National Archives, this vast belly of documents. History, in Brown's view, always remains one thing: speculation drawing on the most relevant possible facts. Historical truth isn't something he can offer me. So much quickly becomes clear. Soon after the end of the war, Theo Morel was subject to investigations by the U.S. Secret Service, some of which were made accessible only a few years ago by the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act. The Americans tried to find out what part the doctor had played, whether he was involved in Hitler's medical decline, which progressed rapidly from the autumn of 1941 onward, or whether he had even tried to poison Hitler. The handling of addictive drugs was the focus of their inquiry. Might we find simple answers here to something that was so difficult to understand? Or did the doctor put himself in the wrong by artificially doping up his patient? From the summer of 1945, Morel was interrogated for 2 years, and according to his own account, tortured. Purportedly, his toenails were pulled out to retrieve his secrets. But the U.S. military didn't get much out of their prisoner. The secret files reveal the frustration of the interrogators, who report contradictory statements. In Morel's medical assessment file, it says, "He is communicative, often gets lost in meaningless trivia when making his statements, and tries to replace the very obvious gaps in his memory with fictions, which often leads to contradictory information. At different times, the patient's psyche shows a completely different picture. In the case of Professor Morel, this is plainly a mild form of exogenous psychosis caused by the fact of his imprisonment. This in no way limits his accountability. On the other hand, his credibility should not be viewed as complete because of the presence of memory gaps which he attempts to bridge with fictions." Morel, according to the file, was not willing or able to explain the relevance of his activities. The statements of three German pharmacologists and doctors who were brought in as experts right after the war weren't any help either. One of the investigations devoted to Morel, Special Report No. 53, entitled "The Rumored Poisoning of Hitler," came to the conclusion that the doctor gave his patient neither enough poison nor enough narcotics to damage his health. Hitler's astonishing physical and psychic decline was presumed to be due only to a huge amount of stress and his largely vegetarian diet. Is this assessment correct? Or should it at least be read with caution due to its proximity to the events as well as its incomplete study of source material? The U.S. authorities had aimed to receive information to dispel the countless myths that had built up around Hitler. In these terms, they ostensibly failed with Morel. On closer examination, the answers actually lie in Morel's notes, although they are hidden and not always easy to interpret. Morel's posthumous papers are a chaotic mass, consisting of scribbled pages from his prescription pads, file pages scattered with cryptic abbreviations, notebooks with barely legible handwriting, diaries filled from cover to cover, loose sheets of paper with observations and descriptions, countless business and personal letters. Entries are repeated, slightly changed, appear again in notebooks, on envelopes, on notes from a telephone pad. From August 1941 until April 1945, the doctor treated his patient on a more or less daily basis. There are accounts for 885 of these 1,349 days. Medications were recorded 1,100 times, as well as almost 800 injections, about one per recorded day. Every now and again, the needles themselves are cleanly stuck onto the notes, as if to give an outward appearance of transparency and conscientious documentation. Morel was afraid of the Gestapo. He knew that personal physicians have always lived dangerously. The result is a chaotic record, a jungle that is almost impossible for outsiders to penetrate, particularly if they have an imperfect command of the German language. Precisely in the alleged over-precision, much remains sketchy, and on an attentive reading it becomes clear that some visits are not recorded. Was Morel, who normally kept his business papers meticulously in order, trying to hide something with this confused representation of events, which was incomplete while simulating completeness? Was he trying to keep a secret that he alone knew, and of which even his patient was unaware? When the war took a fateful turn for the Third Reich, what really happened between Hitler and his personal physician? The bunker mentality. Whenever I was allowed to stay with you more often in headquarters last year, these visits have given me more than you, my Führer, can begin to guess. I have done everything within my power to pass on the abundance of strength that you conveyed to me to as many people as possible. Joseph Goebbels. This entirely unique process cannot be understood with traditional concepts and moral categories. Percy Ernst Schramm. To approach the truth of Hitler's drug consumption, it helps to imagine the place where he spent most of his time between the summer of 1941 and the autumn of 1944. A search for clues in eastern Poland, colossal exploded bunkers lie like crash-landed concrete spaceships in the light-drenched Missourian forest. This is the Wolfschanze, the wolf's lair. Moss has climbed over everything, and birch trees grow on the undulating roofs. Everywhere there are wide cracks you can climb into. Steel reinforcements jut and bend from the crumbling concrete. On every corner, yellow signs have been set up in Polish, German, English. Uwaga! Achtung! Danger! Still, the many tourists from all over the world, numbering almost 1,000 a day, aren't deterred. They clamber into gaping black holes, force their way into chinks, take videos and selfies, as if they're searching for something. In the summer of 1941, the Wolfschanze looked very different. The fortress, protected by mines in a ring between 165 and 500 feet wide, near the East Prussian town of Rustenburg, had just been established and was going into operation. Its core was initially formed by 10 bunkers, the backs of which lay under 6 feet of concrete. This was where the sleeping areas were. The front was relatively less protected and was where the workspaces were set up. The mess hall, where officers ate, formed the middle of the camp and resembled an ugly village pub. A revolutionary star was soon hung behind an ungainly wooden table that sat 20 people, a captured Red Army flag. Hitler arrived on the evening of June 23, 1941, 1 day after the start of the German invasion of the Soviet Union. It was from the Wolf's Lair that he would direct Operation Barbarossa, factoring in no more than 3 months for its victorious conclusion. The soldiers didn't even bring winter uniforms. Because of this hubristic assessment, the location of the headquarters for the Russian campaign had been chosen more or less on a whim. They wouldn't be staying long anyway, it was thought, just like they didn't stay long in the previous headquarters, the Felsennest. This time, they would pay the price for their arrogance. Even in the very first days, there were complaints about the Wolfschanze. It was hard to think of a less hospitable place than this boggy soil between stagnant lakes and marshy ponds. The Führer's abode was soon decried as an airless, lightless camp in the forest, often swathed in fog, the ground contaminated with gasoline that had to be sprayed around the compound to keep the plague of mosquitoes down. A minor official wrote to his wife, "It would be difficult to come up with a more stupid spot. Damp, cold bunkers in which we shiver pitifully at night because of the constant roar of the electric air ventilation system, which causes a terrible draft. We sleep badly and wake up with a headache in the morning. Our linen and uniforms are always cold and damp." Bunker damp and unhealthy, Morel recorded shortly after moving in. He was staying in cramped bunker number 9. A fan rotated on the ceiling, but didn't create any fresh air. Just swirled the mustiness around. Ideal temperature for the breeding of mold. My boots are mildewed, clothes clammy. Stenocardia, anemia, bunker psychosis. Hitler didn't seem to be bothered by any of that. He had already enjoyed the cave-dwelling life in the Felsennest, but it was with the Wolf's Lair that he reached his dream destination, a remote retreat where his life was reduced entirely to the military events at the front. Over the next 3 years, the Wolf's Lair became the center of his life and grew to over 100 different residential and administrative buildings, as well as massive reinforced concrete bunkers, its own rail connection, and airport. Over 2,000 officers, private soldiers, and civilians remained there permanently. No one actually enjoyed the location, except the man who was also known as the boss. He claimed to feel perfectly at home in his bunker. The temperature was always cool and even. Fresh air was pumped in. Morel also had an oxygen tank set up for him, for inhalation and possible release into the bedroom. Führer very content, one might even say enthusiastic. Artificial oxygen supply, protective bunker walls. If it outwardly appeared as if the German Supreme Commander was somewhat close to the action on the front, he was indeed further removed from the realities of war than ever before. This determination to hide himself away, nothing unusual really for dictators, would have disastrous consequences. Over the previous years, the world had always bent to Hitler's will, helping him to achieve incredible victories that had further reinforced his position of power. But as soon as he encountered genuine Russian resistance that couldn't be removed with a sweep of the hand, the greatest commander of all time retreated further and further into his world of make-believe. The microcosm of the wolf's lair was nothing more than a bubble made of concrete and steel. The Soviet Union, as was already clear in July 1941, defended itself bitterly against Hitler's megalomaniac fantasies. Even though the Germans conquered huge amounts of territory in the early weeks of the murderous campaign and took hundreds of thousands of Red Army soldiers prisoner, as more and more space opened up in front of the Wehrmacht, more and more Russian reserves were coming in. Sure, Hitler's troops were winning one battle after another and advanced quickly, encircling the enemy on a huge scale and causing comprehensive chaos just as planned. But the Red Army simply behaved as if it hadn't even noticed these setbacks. That sickly house of cards, Hitler's term for Russia, refused to collapse. Battles were fought ruthlessly on both sides from the very beginning, and for the first time in this war, the Germans suffered great losses within a very short time. Even the doping that had been deployed for this gigantic blitzkrieg advance wasn't much help. The drugs had been delivered to the tank troops, and one army group alone consumed the crazy amount of almost 30 million tablets within only a few months. But Pervitin didn't bring about a quick victory. Soon the spoonful of time was paid for dearly. The Germans eventually had to rest, while the Red Army brought in new divisions from its massive hinterland. During this crucial early phase, in August 1941, Hitler fell ill for the first time in years. As he did at 11 o'clock every morning, his valet, Heinz Linge, already permanently pallid from life in the bunker, knocked at the door of bunker number 13. But Hitler stayed in bed. He had fever and diarrhea, was shivering, and had severe pains in his limbs. Dysentery was presumed. Summoned by telephone to come to the Führer straight away, sudden dizziness. The news of his patient's collapse reached Morel through telephone line 190 in the so-called drone barracks, a claustrophobically cramped, practically unlit working space that he had to share with the son of Hoffmann, the Reich photographer. The doctor quickly looked around for his black bag. The room was full of medications and photographic equipment, stepped outside and hurried to Hitler, whom he found slouched in his bed, collapsed in on himself like a marionette. He was demanding immediate relief from his pain because he wanted to go to the briefing and had serious decisions to make. This time, vitamins and glucose didn't work as they had done before. Nervously and with excessive haste, Morel prepared a mixture of Vitamaltin and calcium and combined it with the steroid Glyconorm, a hormone preparation that he had manufactured himself, which consisted of extract of cardiac muscle, adrenal cortex, and the liver and pancreas of pigs and other farm animals. It was a doping agent. The injection did not go as smoothly as usual. Bent needle during jab. To combat the stinging pains caused by the mishap, Hitler was given 20 drops of Dolantin, an opioid whose effects are similar to those of morphine. But the dysentery-like diarrhea persisted. Patient A had to keep to his bed, and didn't appear during the military briefing held in Keitel and Jodl's bunker at 12 o'clock. Dictator unfit for service, a sensation in operational headquarters, Führer very irritable, Morel wrote that evening, describing his failure. Have never experienced such hostility toward myself. Undeterred, the physician stuck to his pharmacological refresher course, and soon the injections started working. The dysentery was vanquished. The very next day, Hitler took part in the meetings with the generals again and was immediately determined to make up for his one-day collapse. The old conflict between him and the general staff, which had used his absence to act on its own initiative, flared up again. It concerned the continued thrust of the attack, Unlike their leader, the generals saw Moscow as their paramount goal. They planned to take the Russian capital in a decisive battle and win the war by that means. But the freshly cured Hitler had a different strategy. He divided the troops up to conquer Leningrad in the north, cutting the Soviet Union off from the Baltic, while at the same time Army Group South was to advance via the Ukraine into the Caucasus to take the oil resources that were of crucial importance to the war economy. This crisis deeply affected the doctor and his concept of immediate recovery. So that patient A didn't end up in the sick bay again and fall behind, Morell administered a harder course of prophylactic injections and went on to prescribe more and more remedies in ever-changing concentrations. He barely made any diagnoses, but instead constantly added to his basic medicinal treatment. This soon included such diverse substances as tonophosphan, a metabolic stimulant made by the company Hoechst, chiefly used nowadays in veterinary medicine, the hormone-rich and immune system-boosting bodybuilding supplement Homoceran, a byproduct of uterine blood, the sexual hormone testoviran to combat declining libido and vitality, and orchicrin, a derivative of bull's testicles, which is supposed to be a cure for depression. Another substance used was called prostacrinum and was made from seminal vesicles and the prostates of young bulls. Even though he didn't eat meat, Hitler surely could no longer be considered vegetarian. From autumn 1941 onward, more and more highly concentrated animal substances began to circulate in his bloodstream. The purpose of these supplements was to compensate for states of psychological and physical exhaustion, or to prevent them in advance by reinforcing the body's defenses. However, as a result of the constantly changing applications and the rising doses that followed, Hitler's natural immune system was soon replaced by an artificial protective shield. This made Morell increasingly indispensable. This approach to the dictator's health could be compared to using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. In the few walks that Hitler still took in the fresh air of restricted Area 1 at the Wolf's Lair, the doctor always went with him, and a few steps behind followed an assistant with the doctor's bag. The consistency with which this long-term medication was applied is apparent from a train journey in August 1941. Hitler and Mussolini were on their way to the front, a 24-hour journey through Eastern Europe where mass murder was ubiquitous. They passed close by Kamianets-Podilsky in western Ukraine, where over 23,600 Jews had just been shot by the SS and a German police battalion. It was the first murder of all the Jews belonging to a whole region. So that patient A did not have to miss a single injection en route, the Führer's special train stopped in the open countryside, as no injection could be given on the juddering train. The armed anti-aircraft wagon was immediately put at the ready. Morell quickly opened his fat-bellied medical bag, took out the set of ampules wrapped in black leather, removed their napped metal plates, opened the zip fastener of the case in which the syringe was kept, tipped the first ampule over, stuck in the needle, and drew out the fluid. He swiftly bound Hitler's snow-white, almost hairless arm, wiped the sweat from his own forehead, and jabbed in the syringe, first in the vein, then quickly a second intramuscular injection. Morell proudly described the unusual pit stop. Train stopped mid-journey for glucose IV, then tenophosphan forte and vitamaltin calcium IM to the Führer, all done in 8 minutes. Such a process was not a one-off event. It was the norm. The injections increasingly determined the course of the day. Over time, the Führer's medical mixture was enriched by over 80 different and often unconventional hormone preparations, steroids, quack remedies, and balms. There was psychological importance in the fact that the combination of injections changed every day. It meant that Hitler never had the impression of becoming dependent on a particular substance. It was Morell's overall package that he could no longer do without. In his personal physician, he had found a perfect tool for self-medication and self-adjustment that he increasingly began to abuse. This polytoxicomania, which developed in the second half of 1941, sounds bizarre, even for an age in which steroid and hormone research could not begin to guess the effects of the complex interactions of these highly potent substances on the human constitution. Hitler understood less than anyone what was going on in his body. He had always been interested in medication, but had never acquired any medical knowledge. As a drug consumer, as well as a general, he remained an eternal dilettante and allowed himself to be guided by spontaneous suggestions without first understanding basic principles. This was to prove disastrous in the end, for him at least. His natural intuition, which had served him well so often until the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, left him when the injections began to throw his body into chaos. Tolerances build up with intense consumption, and the body accustoms itself to substances. Doses have to be increased, or the effect declines. And the dictator couldn't bear declining effects. In this respect, Morel didn't help the patient in his care. The doctor doesn't seem to have given much thought to problematic interactions, a failure in medical responsibility. An opportunist, a sycophant like so many others, he was too insecure to threaten his advantageous position by imposing a critical form of care on his leader. While in these autumn months of 1941 the systematic murder of the Jews took its course, and the Wehrmacht waged a criminal war of annihilation in Russia that would cause millions of casualties, the National Socialist reign of terror was slowly poisoning itself from within. Eastern Rush. My findings have given me the deepest impression that the Führer is in good health. Joseph Goebbels. On October 2, 1941, the war diary of Wehrmacht High Command records, "At dawn, Army Group Middle went on the offensive in fine autumn weather." Now the attack on the Russian capital was belatedly underway. In a huge battle at Vyazma, halfway between Smolensk and Moscow, a staggering 670,000 Red Army soldiers were taken prisoner. In the Wolf's Lair, some were already declaring victory. But the Germans had lost valuable time and squandered their efforts too much in other theaters of war to be able to take Stalin's power center in a swift operation. When the weather got worse, the advancing soldiers got stuck in the morass. Persistent rain, fog, serious deterioration in the tracks, making all movements and supplies more difficult, the German army leadership reported at the end of October. The possibility of defeat was suggested for the first time. Hitler reacted stoically to the critical situation. When the Red Army launched a counteroffensive with fresh Siberian elite divisions in the early winter, he ignored all appeals from generals to let the troops fall back to avoid further defeats. Instead, on December 16, 1941, he issued a fateful order which had disastrous long-term effects. Hold the line at all costs. Any form of retreat without his express permission was forbidden from now on. The German military, formerly feared because of its unpredictable dynamism, had lost all spontaneity. The astonishing successes of the mobile combat that opened the war were a thing of the past. It is telling that Guderian, who in the spring of 1940 had been partly responsible for the Western campaign victory thanks to his unconventional, consistent disobedience, was now accused by Hitler of standing too close to events when the Panzer general tried to persuade his supreme commander to take back the front lines close to Moscow. Hitler's only prescription at this point was fanatical resistance with no regard for casualties, and with no regard, in fact, for the reality of the front. In this first winter of the Eastern War, the Wehrmacht was therefore severely beaten, and in Moscow the church bells rang confidently. Orthodox priests hurried from house to house, from hut to hut, in full regalia and with raised crucifixes, to drum up men and women, young and old, to make the ultimate sacrifice for sacred Russian soil. All over the Soviet Union, pictures flickered across screens, showing Red Army soldiers putting on quilted clothing and shoes made of felt, while German prisoners, without coats or gloves, performed a macabre dance, barefoot on the icy ground, to try to keep from freezing to death. Hopeless situations accumulated for the aggressors. Often the only thing that helped was Pervitin. One of the many examples, in the fishing village of Vzvad, on the southern shore of Lake Ilmen, between Moscow and Leningrad. The Germans were encircled, their accommodations set on fire, rations arriving only sporadically from the ice-cold air. One last tiny window of escape was open, and 500 exhausted men, loaded with heavy bags and machine guns over their shoulders, began a 14-hour night march through waist-deep snow. Soon many men were, as the official Wehrmacht report has it, in a state of extreme exhaustion. The snowfall had stopped from around midnight, and the sky was filled with stars. Enervated soldiers wanted to lie down in the snow. In spite of energetic pep